Billy Coble is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Coble to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for half of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Marlo Blue, with criminal defense attorneys Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, Jack Lee, and Paige Yannick. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Linda Huhan. The Execution Watch for Billy Coble begins.
Good evening and welcome to the Wednesday, February 28th edition of Execution Watch. Whether you're listening live on one of our FM channels, 90.1 FM Houston, 89.7 Huntsville, or simulcast through any of our stations and archived at kpft.org, thank you for joining us. I am your host, Marlo Blue. If you are tuning in for Living Arts with your host Michael Woodson, usually heard here every Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m., you can hear it on the HD2 channel. Please check back next week when it resumes its regularly scheduled slot. And please remember that KPFT, this part of the Pacifica Network, is in pledge drive, and we are asking you to make your donation to keep the station alive. We welcome your opinions on social media and beyond. To learn more about the death penalty and executions in the state of Texas, you can join us on Facebook at Execution Watch or online at executionwatch.org. Join our mailing list for all of the latest updates. Tonight we stand in vigil as the state of Texas plans to execute Billy Coble for killing three of his wife's family members in the Waco area nearly three decades ago. Joining us in the studio to put this case in perspective is our panel of experts, Larry B. Douglas, Mike Gillespie, Jack Lee, and Paige Yannick. Now, when I spoke with Billy Coble's lawyer, Richard Ellis, he says this all comes down to two major things. I'd like to know, we're going to get a little perspective from Jack Lee when we start. But first, let's go to our representative outside of the death house, our reporter Linda Huhan, who's joining us now live by phone from outside the death house in Huntsville. Linda, thank you for joining us, and describe the scene to us tonight.
Well, the witnesses are just now crossing the line. The first people that went in was the media. And now the witnesses have just entered the death house.
And who, do you know who is standing witness? I heard that perhaps his son and his son's wife was going to be there, and maybe a couple of pen pals. Is that correct?
Yes, his son, his son's wife, and then a lady from Switzerland who was a pen pal, and then one of the church members that comes from Corpus Christi is there with him too, and then another pen pal.
And as you say, what is the atmosphere like there tonight? Of course, this is another case where I believe the brother, who was one of the ones who was deceased, was also a sergeant in the police department in Waco. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. So far, we have not seen any police officers here. So hopefully it'll be quiet.
Yeah. Well, Linda, anything else you wanted to describe the scene? I know it's a very dreary, sad day in the state of Texas right now. It's getting colder as we speak.
Yes, there's about 15 of us out here for Bill. And we haven't had any ugly comments. We've had nobody driving by being rude to us tonight. So hopefully it's going to be very peaceful.
Mm-hmm. Well, since we know that there is no word of a stay from, of course, the Texas Board of Pardons has already denied, and I believe the Supreme Court did earlier today, denied his request. If you would please, Linda, call us when you hear something.
We certainly will.
Thank you so much. All right, now we're going to go back to here into the studio right here at 419 Lovett Boulevard. Let's go to Jack Lee for some insight. Jack, tell us what's going on with this story.
So what I'd like to do is first I'd like to start off with the facts of the case, what happened and what we saw in the appellate record. One of the things, there are several issues here that I think are actually real interesting with the, that are raised with this case. One of them is actually the dissent by Clinton, a wonderful dissent in this case, and Michael will handle that.
That's great, but tell me who Clinton is and what
Clinton.
He represents
My
involved
apologies.
In this.
Clinton is was the Criminal Court of Appeals justice, and he wrote a real good dissent about this regarding the continuous action, and Michael will get into that. We also have an issue with Penry and punishment, and Paige will cover that, and Larry will also talk about the other issues regarding expert witnesses and what happened with psychiatrist. Larry and I won't talk about that, and we'll also cover the what I call the kitchen sink argument, which is the ineffective assistance of counsel. But let me first go in with the facts. So, Coble, he was married to a woman named Karen for about a year, and it just didn't work out from the beginning. And she had two children. He had one, and he ended up. One day, he takes the three children come home. He handcuffs them, binds them, puts them into a room, blindfolds them, and tells them that he's going to kill a bunch of people. And first, the brother-in-law, who happens to be a police officer in McClellan County, which is Waco, Texas, he comes home and. Billy Coble went out and got into a scuffle with him, shot and killed him with his own gun. Then later on, comes back to the children and, talks to them and says, he seems uncertain whether he is going to kill them or not. And then then he goes to the parents' house, his father-in-law and mother-in-law's house across the street. And he kills first the mother, comes back, talks to the children again, and then goes back and kills the father. When the father comes back.
There is a certain amount of proximity. As you said, they
yes.
did live across the street from each other in a very small town.
Correct. The parents lived across, the parents-in-law, lived across the street. The brother-in-law, lived down the street.
Mm-hmm.
So when Karen came back, he ambushed her and, tied her up, with toy handcuffs. Toy handcuffs. Apparently they held. But at any rate, they were handcuffs. And he threatened her, showed her, admitted to killing, the brother-in-law, the mother-in-law, and the father-in-law. And he had gone and, he had also taken money from the father and the mother-in-law. And then, threatened to kill the children, and Karen was able to convince him not to kill the children. So he took her, kidnapped her, they drove off high speed chase, over the course of, several hours, went into a field. When it got late, they came out again. A police officer happened to see them, turned around, chased after him. He ran Karen's car into another parked car in order to do whatever. Anyways, but he said, well, I guess you'll have to, he told Karen, well, I guess you'll have to do, get a new car, but not before, during the high speed chase, stabbing her several times in the face and throat.
Is she still alive?
I believe she is.
Now, despite all this horrific sounding events, and there is no question that this is horrific, this is a gentleman, or this is a man that was, had other problems as well.
Sure.
He had been institutionalized by the state of Texas for over 12 years, I believe.
That's correct. He grew up in a children's home because the father was an alcoholic, abused his mother. The mother was in real bad shape, highly depressed. The three children were sent away. His oldest sister was particularly promiscuous, so she was sent to a convent school. And, yeah, like that's a solution. Anyways, sorry. Then, you know, he was in, you know, he caused a lot of problems. Eventually he had some psych evaluations when he was 17, basically that he had a lot of problems.
And there's documented abuse of other women and violence towards women
this was
in his life.
Karen was his third wife.
Mm-hmm.
The first wife he married immediately after, within 3 months, I believe, after getting back from the Vietnam War.
And very interesting aspect of this that I haven't seen anywhere, but when I spoke with Richard Ellis, who was, of course, Billy's lawyer, he said that the murder itself, the murders of the victims, the couple and the son, were almost done in pure stress mode. He covered the bodies with sheets the same way that they
mummified. He mummified them
in Vietnam, and so there was obviously huge distress in this entire situation.
Yeah, sure.
Was all that taken into account in this case?
It's hard to say because we don't actually have the appellate record, but you know, if you were to go to the trial record, it would be tens of thousands of pages, and none of us really have, I apologize, but the four of us don't really have the time to go through all of that in preparation for this program. But
and there were actually two trials in this case.
Correct.
Is that correct?
I'll get into that.
Okay.
So he was married three times. The first time was to an 18-year-old. They had one son together. He beat her and threatened to hurt. There was stalking involved. There was all kinds of bad behavior. When her father tried to rescue her, he threatened him as well. And so they were together for 2 years. So later on, with his second wife. Again, repeat abuse. When she threw something at him, he beat her with a sledgehammer. Meanwhile, in the first marriage, he raped his sister-in-law's 15-year-old. He raped his 15-year-old sister-in-law, and then during the second marriage, he raped a cousin or molested a cousin and also his niece.
Was he ever charged and convicted of these crimes?
None. This all came out during punishment phase.
Okay.
So, at any rate, he's not somebody you want to invite over for dinner. He's, he has a record. And what happened, one of the issues that I thought was real interesting about this is that in order for a murder to be a capital murder, it has to, while you're in the continuance of a crime, you have to commit a murder. So if he kills all three in a continuous, commits the murder, as a continuous murder in all three, that becomes a capital murder. On the other hand, if he simply goes out and kills one, pause, and then different transaction kills another, pause, and then another third transaction kills another, these are three separate murders, but it's not a capital murder. And now there are other ways to get to a capital murder. The brother-in-law was a police officer. Killing him is a capital capital murder. Killing the parents, if they please go ahead.
I just want everyone to know that this is Execution Watch. The time is 6:15. You are listening to KPFT 90.1 FM. If you are here looking for Living Arts with your host, Michael Woodson, please, you may tune in to the HD2 channel here on KPFT. This is Execution Watch. Please continue.
All right. So there's a fairly lengthy discussion in the original opinion about how these murders were all in one continuous act, and Michael is going to handle that issue along with the dissent. Michael, you want to talk about this? It's real interesting, isn't it?
Well, what's interesting is that all of this started as a way to protect people. This goes back to what we call the Carving Document. A man breaks into a house, kills people, burns the house down, he steals everything in the house. You can charge him with multiple crimes. In order to narrow that so the man doesn't face multiple prosecutions, the state has got to pick out what they're going to charge him with. That's called the Carving Document. Carve out what you want to charge with. That's the basis of this. The problem becomes, on this case, they're trying very careful not to upset the Carving Document by not trying to make the state pick one crime to do. The issue here, as Jack said, did he take a gun and make three shots and kill three people? Or like in this case, he shot one, took a break, shot another, took a break, and shot another. The law addresses that by calling it the same scheme of conduct, meaning it's the same actions over and over again. And the example of that is somebody who is a hitman. He kills somebody, then kills somebody a month later, and kills somebody a month later. He's still a hitman, but is that the same, not the same transaction? It's three different transactions.
Yes, but the difference here.
This is Paige Janik speaking.
The difference here is that all of these activities in this one particular case with Mr. Coble involved a 3-hour period.
I agree, but I'm talking about what the dissent said.
Yeah.
What the
dissent, well, and Judge Clinton's dissent is fabulous, so go for it.
Well, what he seems to be doing, he doesn't disagree with it. He's just trying to be more specific because this is a big issue, not just for capital case, but also because in Carving cases. Could this same argument be used to a defendant's benefit? It could be. And that's why he was so specific on what he did. I don't think anybody, and one thing that's interesting is they talk about this is not a legislative decision. This is a jury decision. The legislator just says continuing transactions. It's up to people to decide what that means. I don't think anybody would think that when you go grocery shopping, buying meat, a bun, and lettuce are three different transactions. You're going grocery shopping because you mingle in the grocery store for an hour and buy three different items. Is that three different transactions, or is it one transaction to make a hamburger? These are issues that are vague. These are issues that I think common sense, and that's what Clinton talks about, common sense tells you what it is. And in this case, you can make the argument that it was a period of time, it was three different shootings, there was a break between the times. The fact that he stopped and dealt with the children between the time shows a break. The fact that he mummified or covered the bodies shows a break. I think you can argue there's three different times, but nobody can argue that he went out to kill the family in one transaction and it was a continuing scheme to kill the family. So,
well, I think I think, Michael, that and you and I, and we all discussed this earlier, there's a common thread in Texas jurisprudence. We like juries to make decisions. And in this case, the jury was given the opportunity to choose whether this was a continuous act, or if this was three separate independent acts. And in the appellate records tells us that the prosecution actually came out and said, don't let the defense fool you. don't let the defense do this and try to convince you that this is all, you know, all, that this is not a continuous action, that it's in fact three separate ones. And I think this goes back to Texas jurisprudence. We like juries. We like juries to make decisions. We like to, juries to split the hairs and decide where juries, where the facts actually fall, how to interpret facts, things like that. Because we're Texas. We have we trust the common man, and a jury is made out of common men.
Do you think a jury is a proper person? Let's keep guilt or innocent out of it. Because
sure.
Guilt and innocent by constitution is by a jury.
Correct.
But once somebody is found guilty, do they have less constitutional rights to have a jury?
Well, I mean, in this issue of continuous or not continuous action, we're still in guilt innocence.
Yeah, because isn't that a decision for the DA to make on how they form the complaint? Like you said, they could have made it capital on the brother by himself because he's a police officer.
Sure.
So the question becomes, if they put all their eggs in one basket and something goes wrong, he goes free.
Sure.
Does it make not more sense from the state's viewpoint to have three separate trials and three different shots at the apple?
It might, but they wanted a bigger apple. They wanted a death penalty case and not three separate murders.
And nonetheless, we're here now.
Okay, which gets to the next issue. Why is this being tried in Waco?
That's the county where it happened.
We're going to file the motion, change of venue, that was denied unequivocally. But you can use the argument that, yes, yeah, certain things should be tried in the community. And, for example, I work in Channelview. Two men getting a fistfight in Channelview is different than two men getting a fistfight in West University. You need to be judged by your neighborhoods. I understand that. But when it comes to capital murder, that should be the same no matter what county you're in. Is there an argument that says that all capital cases should be removed from the community it happened? Because if it's bad enough to kill you, it shouldn't be a question of what neighborhood you live in. It's bad enough to kill you. And the fact you got a police officer in a small town that everybody knows, you got publicity, why wasn't this case moved?
Well, they actually did. This issue was brought up in the original trial.
And denied.
And it was denied.
But was it denied based on more technicalities for the affidavit? Or denied because they didn't want to move it?
Oh, I think they... if you look at the appellate record, the trial court did not commit error.
Well, the affidavits were so vague, it was a police officer saying he can get a fair trial here.
The affidavits were, on both sides, were very obviously written by lawyers.
That's right.
They were very obviously written by lawyers. And they were written specifically to be able to defeat appeals.
So, my question again, why is a punishment different because what part of the state you committed it? Why, if you commit a crime in Houston, is a punishment different than you commit the crime in Waco? This is the state of Texas with the same laws. Shouldn't you be judged by the same laws?
I'm not privy to the machinations of Providence.
Are you asking what causes prosecutorial discretion?
Number one, prosecutor's discretion, and number two, in terms of the fact that certain crimes like the death penalty are such serious crimes, it should be no doubt that you're guilty because of where it was tried should not be an issue.
Well, it's not an issue because we have the possibility of changing venue. The issue of venue was adjudicated in this case, and it was denied a change of venue.
My question is, don't you think all death penalty cases, as a general rule, should be moved out of the county where the murders happened, just to be fair?
That sounds like a remedy that should be addressed.
Which is why
A conversation that we should be having. But perhaps not at this moment. Perhaps what our real concern is that Billy, who is, you know, 70 years of age, he's been on death row for almost 30 years. He's, according to all people, he's the different person than went in, as we always hear this has happened. But let's go back to what happened to Billy Cobble. What was his basis for appeals when he did have his first appeal?
Well, actually, the it's real interesting. The Kabul trial happened during during two critical opinions, and Paige is going to handle that. It's the penury issue.
Let's talk about it.
Well, basically, what had happened is his original capital trial was held in 1990. Penry 1 came down sometime in the 80s, dealing with mentally deficient defendants. And Penry 2 came down in the early 90s, and it dealt with the issue of punishment in relation to these specific defendants. And it also honed our punishment scheme on capitals, our being the state of Texas. So when Mr. Kobol was convicted in the first case, the first trial, and sentenced to death in 1990, it was after Penry 1 and before Penry 2. We changed the penal code in 1991, and we revamped punishment in capital murders during that change of the penal code. And so when it came back on a retrial in 2008, yes?
2007.
Okay. When it came back on the retrial for punishment in 2007, it was operating under the present penal code as opposed to the penal code and the code of criminal procedure, which was in effect at the time of the murder originally. In any event, the punishment process in the second trial dealt with the fact that mitigation and future dangerousness were now the issues to be determined.
Was that the reason why there was a second trial?
Yes. It was having to do with punishment based upon Penry 2.
So that we're clear, I want to make sure that everyone listening understands that in every criminal case in Texas, you have the guilt-innocent phase, and then you have the punishment phase. The guilt-innocence was untouched by Penry. This is only the punishment. So Kobol was tried twice only on the punishment issue. So the first punishment was set aside in pending another trial. And what we're talking about about this second trial is on punishment only. Basically asking a fresh jury, what's your opinion about, whether Kobol should be executed, should be given the death penalty or not?
Of course, now, talking about this brought up a whole nother issue. And again, going back to Richard Ellis, he says this was about perjury and junk science. Why does he say that Mr. Kobol is being murdered or executed at this point in time because of the state of Texas's denial of these problems?
Well, I can address the junk science. The junk science is specifically about a psychiatrist named Coons. Coons has actually, interestingly enough, the Kobol case. In the Kobol case, the Fifth Circuit came back and said, you know, we're just not buying it. We think you're, I'm sorry, it was the Criminal Court of Appeals.
And that's Clinton?
No, this is a different, was it Keller? Oh, I'm sorry. Larry, that's a subject for Larry. Larry, right. Will you want to hop in here?
Please.
Sorry about that.
This, of course, is Larry Douglas. Larry.
Okay, as Jack mentioned, Mr. Kobol, his case was overturned for the punishment issue. So guilt innocence was already determined in the first case, and the reversal was to review the punishment issue. Now, the thing about punishment in a capital case, he's already been found guilty of capital murder. So there's only one two possibilities, okay, life or death. So that's the whole purpose of the latter trial was to decide, do you put him to death? And the two competing factors in that second punishment hearing, by that time the law had been crystallized to provide for the primary issues to be considered were future danger and mitigation. Okay, future danger, is he going to be a future danger to, really, at that point, the future danger issue was, nobody was under the impression that Coble was going to walk free. So the people that he was going to be of danger to were the people, if they left, allowed him to live, people inside a penal institution. And by that time, by the time of the second hearing, Coble had been inside a penal institution for 18 years and had been a pretty model inmate, had not had any disciplinary problems at all. He was safe inside. He was not a particular danger inside the penal institution. So the prosecution's job was, if we're going to kill this man, we've got to convince the jury that he will be a future danger, because the mitigation evidence was pretty overwhelming. Coble lived a terrible life. He was a victim of terrible, his mother, being a drug addict and so forth, and just not a...
All right, we'll get back to this in just a moment, but right now we have a little breaking news. The time, of course, is 6:32. You are listening to KPFT 90.1 FM. You are listening to a very special edition of Execution Watch right here on this station. Let's go live, please, to Linda Hujan, who is in front of the death house in Huntsville. Linda, what's going on there?
There's been a very big ruckus. We're not sure exactly what's going on, but we do know that someone has been brought out in handcuffs and they've thrown him in a police car. We don't know who it is. We couldn't tell. It's kind of dark here. If it was the grandson or the son, it's one of the men that was in the witness room. So we're waiting to hear what's going on. We don't know.
Does anyone there have a police scanner?
Do what now?
Does anyone there have a police scanner?
Not the standing with us.
All right. And is there any other continuing information that's going on? Is there any other ruckus, as it were?
Okay. Thank you. Someone's going back to the hospitality house right now to find out what happened, because they took his daughter-in-law back to the hospitality house. The police did, and we don't know what happened. There was just something bad happening there. We don't know if Bill has deceased yet or not. The other witnesses have not come out.
Linda,
we've never seen anything like this before, so this is very, very odd.
This is very unusual.
Yes.
Linda, we're going to ask you to keep in touch with the control room back there with our producer, Elizabeth, and keep us in touch, all right?
Okay.
And please let us know what the status is, both of the grandson, the daughter-in-law, and, of course, Billy Coble.
Okay. All the other witnesses just now came out, so apparently it's over.
Okay.
And we'll let you know as soon as we know something what actually happened.
Thank you very much.
Right, thank you.
While we wait to hear back from Linda to find out what has happened, let's continue on. I'm sorry, Jack?
So that listeners have a perspective as to what just happened.
Yeah.
When the folks leave the death house, and they go, there's a chapel next to the death house. The body of Billy Coble will be moved to the chapel
once he's expired,
so that the family can touch his body while it's still warm. And this is something that that's done as a courtesy, so that the family, because the family has not been able to.
The first time that many of them will have had an opportunity to touch him
in 30
since
years.
He's correct. Almost 30 years.
But at any rate, I believe Larry was going to continue talking about Coons and the Daubert issue.
Right, right. Now, a horrendous childhood that Billy Coble suffered from. His father died before he was born. His mother had some very serious mental health issues and drug issues. Abusive stepfather, grew up in a pretty much just a state home, was a Vietnam vet, with an apparent, well-documented history of suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. So the mitigation evidence was pretty strong. To combat that, the prosecutors brought in what's called future danger evidence now, and they used experts to do that. Now, experts are critical in issues like this because an expert can actually express an opinion as to a legal issue, and the legal issue being, will this man be a future danger? State brings in an expert to say, this man is a future danger. Even if he's in the penal institution, he's still a future danger.
And which expert was this that testified specifically?
They brought in a medical doctor, Dr. Coons.
Okay. Richard Coons.
Okay. He was brought in for the primary purpose of saying that Billy Coble will be a future danger. Now, in order to do that, in order for the expert to get on the witness stand and testify that way, the expert has to be qualified. And so before the expert testifies, there is a hearing to determine whether this expert is indeed qualified. It's called the Daubert hearing. So they had the hearing, and Dr. Coons testifies at the hearing. Now the essence of the hearing is to determine, you know, is this a scientific basis for him testifying this way? Is there a scientific theory? Does he understand the theory? And does he apply it properly, saying this will be Coble will be a future danger? The court let it in. Okay. And the appeals court says, when you look at the totality of the circumstances, Coons never should have testified. Okay. He did not, it was not based on science, and science has certain, qualities about it, including predictability. The expert for the defense talked about Coble's testimony, said it's pretty much like reading the tea leaves. And if you look at what he's doing, there was an expert who testified at the original trial, who said that using the same kind of information, the same kind of theories, that Coons used, saying in essence that Coble was not a future danger. And in fact, the expert at the original trial says the jurors themselves are more of a danger than Coble is.
Mm-hmm.
So it was faulty expert testimony, and the appeals court says Coons never should have been allowed to testify.
Well, and the state of Texas, to my understanding, never has denied that he shouldn't have been allowed to testify. They've never denied that, have they ever controverted or denied that the testimony was wrong.
That's not the end of it. The mere fact that Coons never should have been allowed to testify does not end the issue. Okay, because then the appeals court has to determine whether his testimony violated a fundamental right that Billy Coble had, and that is, is there other evidence that substantiates the verdict of death? And the court determines, when you look at the totality of the circumstances, even in the absence of Coons' testimony, the essence of what they're saying is he would have been found, the jury would likely have found that he was a future danger. Now we have no way of knowing that.
And we're saying that he would be a future danger to general population in prison? Because we know he's not getting out.
We know exactly. But the population prison. I mean that is, you know, that's the society that they'd be in.
Right.
Okay. And so everybody understands that and understands that. And he had been a model prisoner for 18 years, but the prosecutor used the Coons testimony. Okay, although they downplayed, say we didn't really use it. But when you look at his argument, because his argument is to try to say, don't look at that 18 years. See, Billy Coble is the same Billy Coble now as he was back then. There has not been any change. And if you look at what Dr. Coons says, that substantiates it. Now they downplay the role that Coons, played, but when you look at the, if Coons had not been there, because the defense had another doctor, but he was a psychologist, not
Dr. Cunningham.
So he was a psychologist, not a psychiatrist. So Dr. Cunningham, the psychologist, talked about the methodology that he used, and the methodology that he used had a certain element, was based on predictability. If you say he's not going to be a danger in the future, then you have to look at the factors that you evaluate, that you use for, as a measuring tool, and find out whether those factors have been used in the past and have those factors been reliable. Well, Dr. Cunningham clearly and methodically went through the factors that he used as compared to Dr. Coons. And the defense lawyer tried to explain, you know, the fact is, Coons was saying he'll be a future danger, just sort of almost just based on his impressions of common sense. And so, well, the jury could do that themselves. But when you take a look at the factors, that have to be done methodically, okay, in the way that, and when you do things methodically using science, a lot of times it's pretty dry, okay, and it's not nearly as persuasive as an opinion, which Coons was allowed to give based on more of his hunch. The other thing is, people tend to believe if it's scientific evidence, you got one guy who's a doctor, an MD, as compared to a psychologist, a PhD, people tend to want to believe the doctor, no matter how unreliable his testimony seems to be. So the court, while I think it was really good, well, it just made sense for them. When you look at the way the defense presented its case, in terms of the Cunningham versus Coons, it was fairly clear that Coons' testimony never should have come in. And the court decided Coons' testimony never should have come in, but it didn't make any difference anyway.
And part of the reason why it wouldn't make any difference is that, again, getting back to Texas jurisprudence, we like juries to make decisions. In this case, the jury was given both sides. They were given Coons' opinion, they were given Cunningham's opinion, and the jury made the determination that, you know what, we believe this guy is going to be a future danger. And, you know,
but on that point, Jack.
Uh-huh, sure.
On that point, Jack. When you consider what if, and we can't really get a definitive answer. To
sure,
this,
of course not.
But what would the jury have determined if Coons had not had if the court had ruled properly and left Coons's testimony out? It's like our mentor Jim Skelton used to joke about, saying, if the state brings forth an expert, whether he's qualified or not, he gets to testify.
And
the defense has a much harder road to hoe.
Yes, we do.
When it comes to bringing an expert, but the state's expert here never should have been allowed to testify, and his testimony was, I'm convinced, persuasive to the jury.
Larry, do you mind if
how long ago was this that this actually happened?
2007.
So we're still talking about a 60-something year old man.
Correct.
Who'd had
70.
Multiple heart attacks.
Well,
yes. But when
now,
this happened,
now 70.
60 year old man.
Correct.
Yeah. No, he's 70s now.
90 was the original trial. Okay. But we're talking about the retrial for the punishment
phase in
2007. And we're talking about a man who was a sicko man.
Right.
How is he a threat to general population?
More important on this point, he was a model prisoner.
Right.
He had demonstrated a lack of danger to the people, the inmate population, the prison population for 18 years.
Larry, mm-hmm. Do you mind if I throw some gasoline on your fire here? Coons, the Texas Criminal Court of Appeals, had actually come out and said that Coons made up his own methodology. So it's not like it was ever peer reviewed. He created something out of whole cloth.
His testimony suggested that's just the way, when he was testifying,
right.
He said, that's just the kind of the way I do it.
It was flying by the seat of his pants. That's his expert witness testimony.
Which made absolutely no sense whatsoever in terms of an expert coming forward to testify and say, I have no methodology. This is just the way I do it.
Okay, I want to go on to something other than that, because my question is now, he put in, of course, there was an appeal. First, of course, to the Texas Board of Parole and Pardons. It was denied, just flat out denied. And then
Criminal
again,
Court of Appeals.
To right. SCOTUS, to the Supreme Court. And
goes to the Fifth Circuit first.
Okay. All right. So my question, someone has been bringing up the McCoy claim. What was that, and why would it have appealed, in your opinion?
McCoy was not mentioned in the appellate record.
And so it wasn't actually placed in there?
No, I'm not real sure what they're talking
about. And to the appellate record for the Fifth Circuit?
For everything that I've read in the appellate record, McCoy was not mentioned.
What would McCoy have done?
No idea. I don't know which McCoy case this is.
My understanding is this was specifically regarding the McCoy in Louisiana case, where the defendant was allowed to actually place his, or expected to put in his defense of guilty or not guilty. And their question seems to be that Billy was not able to do that in either of his trials, that his defense lawyer in the first trial in 1990 just pled guilty.
So we're now talking about ineffective assistance of counsel.
Nobody pled guilty.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the first trial.
There was a trial of guilt and innocence.
Correct.
But going back one moment more to Linda Hujan, please. Linda, are you there? Oh, I'm sorry. All right, we'll go back to it.
In the first trial, in the first appeal,
Marlo,
you asked earlier
can I just,
what things were brought up on the first
to
appeal.
To the McCoy discussion?
We brought up 14 different points.
By the way, it was brought up, it's not in the record, Jack, it was brought up by Coble's defense attorney. And what the McCoy decision held was that,
so we now have data
based on the Sixth Amendment, a defendant is able to tell his lawyer, even if the lawyer insists otherwise, that he may not tell the jurors that, okay, he did it
Louisiana's a code state.
But for this reason, he shouldn't get the death penalty. And that's what happened in Louisiana. The
Wasn't in the appellate record, what good
is it? I'm sorry, Jack, what?
If this wasn't in the appellate record, what good is this discussion?
Okay. Jack, this was not in the appellate record. This is from
what good is the discussion if it's not in the appellate record with regards to this case?
I guess it's up to the listener. The connection is that his defense attorney talked about this in an interview with Marlo, and I thought that was really, really interesting. And what happened in the Louisiana case was that the defendant, who was later freed by the Supreme Court, essentially, kept telling his defense attorney, do not say I did the crime, because I didn't.
Well, you know that because we had a guilt-innocence phase, there was no guilty plea. So where does this leave McCoy?
This is what the defense attorney told Marlo.
I understand.
It's inapposite because it does not apply to the facts of this case.
I'm trying real hard to understand how this square peg goes into this round hole.
Anyway, Marlo, that was a good interview you did. What did he talk about it in context of?
Specifically, Richard Ellis was saying that this is what they had put into the last request in order to try and save Billy Koble's life. This is what they were bringing to the attention.
So I guess it's difficult for me to speculate what Richard Ellis is talking about, having not read anything, not understanding the subtleties of his argument.
I apologize.
I can't speculate. I mean, yeah.
It seems like a very reasonable thing, and again, we're talking about a 70-year-old man. We're talking about a 70-year-old man who has been a model citizen, as you've just said, in jury, in prison.
Except this is Texas. We want to punish people who did bad things by killing them. That's the purpose of what we're doing on this show.
Well, let me back up here. I was having lunch one day with the I believe he was the chairman of the Texas Board Board of Pardons, and he suggested something that made an awful lot of sense. The purpose for TDCJ is twofold. One, I hate you, and two, I love you. I hate you, I want you to go to prison for the rest of your life, or I want to kill you. Two, I love you, I want to rehabilitate you. Both of these threads for purposes for TDCJ are inconsistent. What we haven't figured out how to do is fish or cut bait. Either do one or the other. Are we a system that is, hey, we're just out for blood. We want a pound of flesh. Or are we here specifically to rehabilitate people? And no matter how long it takes, we're committed to it, and so on.
I'd like to read something right now that has just come up over the wires from KCNTV in Huntsville. Billy Wayne Koble has been executed, and some of his family were arrested after causing a scene. He was pronounced dead at 6:24 p.m. Two men were taken in away in cop cars, and a woman was escorted off the premises. We know from our reporter Linda Hujan that was the granddaughter. I apologize, but some of the Koble family were thrown out of the execution and arrested after causing a scene. Billy Wayne Koble has been pronounced dead at 6:24 p.m. He was executed by the state of Texas. He was on death row for about three decades, convicted again of the 1989 capital murder charges for killing the parents of his estranged wife, Robert Vicka, and Zelda Vicka, and her brother, Waco Police Sergeant Bobby Vicka.
You mentioned something about witnesses lying in earlier, Marlo.
Yeah,
and I wanted to address that. So he admitted at trial, at the guilt innocent phase, he admitted to three witnesses, the children who he had bound and locked up, that he had killed three people. He then turned around and told his then wife Karen that he had killed three people
who he had tied up and
correct. And then at the hospital, when they were treating him for injuries that he suffered while fighting the deceased brother-in-law Bobby, who was the police officer, he then admitted that he killed three people, and a police officer who was there happened to tape record it. So there really was not much of an issue as far as guilt innocence. This whole idea of I'm not real sure what Ellis was talking about with witnesses lying, and if it's Coons, well, he's probably right about that. If it's not expert witness testimony, then I'm not real sure where that's coming from. Because it was the guilt innocence. This is fairly clear cut. He admitted on multiple occasions to multiple people that he'd killed three people. It's on tape that was played to the jury. Yeah, it's the guilt innocence was not a question in this case.
Does anyone here think that there are mitigating circumstances to someone who was so poorly served by every aspect of government in this man's life?
I think that can apply to a lot of people who don't commit crimes and not put in the penitentiary. The fact remains is that we have spent a tremendous amount of money on this man by keeping him locked up. If you're asking me, could that money have been better spent and should be better spent on social services to try to avoid this, you're right. But we don't do that.
I would challenge the premise that it is the state's responsibility to raise people, to provide services for them. I think it's the responsibility of individuals, their families, and their communities to do right by them.
It is, but the question becomes, when that doesn't happen, do we just kill them?
Life is hard.
Then we just kill them.
No, I don't say we don't.
I think society kills them itself without the government, because the question now is not do you deserve to die, it's does the government deserve to kill you. If people act out, there's going to be risk, there's going to be something happening in the world that you might get killed, but it's not the government killing you. And keep in mind, Marla, what you said, that now he's been executed, according to the state of Texas, he wasn't executed, he was murdered. The government
is
murdered
a homicide.
Him.
It's a homicide. The death certificate
question
is homicide.
We have now is not should he deserve to die. The question is, did the state have the right to kill him rather than society kill him? Meaning, somebody does something like this, there can be people right there on the scene who would kill him. Nobody would question that. We'll question, should the government kill him 30 years later?
All right.
Again, you have been listening to Execution Watch. If you were trying to listen to Living Arts, it was on HD2. You may always hear them again next week. And please listen in. Billy Wayne Coble has been put to death by the state of Texas. And there has been an interesting scene going on with other members of the Coble family, which we have reported via KCET-TV. This program is the first and only live electronic vigil where we provide firsthand reports of the death machine in Texas in action. And we appreciate those of you who are joining us internationally and on the World Wide Web. And please stay tuned for our next execution, which we hope will not happen again. That's going to happen on March the 28th with Patrick Murphy. We do ask you to check in on Facebook at Execution Watch or online at executionwatch.org. Join our mailing list for all the latest updates. Please stop by kpft.org to show your support for this program and others, and make your secure contribution to this station. Thanks to our panel, Larry B. Douglas, Jack Lee, Mike Gillespie, and Paige Yannick, Death House reporter Linda Hujan, executive producer Elizabeth Stein, and our engineer Gordon Anderson for their assistance on today's program. Up next, Progressive Form with Wally. On behalf of the Execution Watch crew, I'm Marlo Blue. Good night. Make a bitch. Data justice. Hypocrite.